Welcome to Nightlights. This is David Brent Johnson, and for the next hour, we'll be listening to the spoken performances of one of 20th century American literature's most influential authors and the jazz that inspired or was inspired by him. And we'll be talking with musicologist Phil Ford about it all. It's Jazz and Jack Kerouac, coming up on this edition of Nightlights.
Old Man Mose, early American jazz pianist, had a grandson called Deadbelly. Old Man Mose walloped the rollicking Keyport, Wahoo Wild Hosts, Piani, with monkeys in his hair, drooling spaghetti, beer, and beans, with a cigar mashed in his countenance, of gleaming happiness, the furtive madman of old sane times. Deadbelly don't hide it. Lead killed Leadbelly. Deadbelly admit. Deadbelly modern cat. Cool. Deadbelly man. Craziest. Old man Moses dead. But Deadbelly get ahead. Charlie Parker looked like Buddha. Charlie Parker, who recently died laughing at a juggler on TV after weeks of strain and sickness, was called the perfect musician. And his expression on his face was as calm, beautiful, and profound as the image of the Buddha represented in the East. The lidded eyes, the expression that says, all is well. This was what Charlie Parker said when he played, all is well. He had the feeling of early in the morning, like a hermit's joy, or like the perfect cry of some wild gang at a jam session, wail, whop. Charlie burst his lungs to reach the speed of what the speedsters wanted, and what they wanted was his eternal slowdown. A great musician and a great creator of forms that ultimately find expression in mores and what have you. Musically as important as Beethoven, yet not regarded as such at all. A genteel conductor of string orchestras in front of which he stood, proud and calm, like a leader of music in the great historic world night, and wailed his little saxophone, the alto, with piercing clear lament, in perfect tune and shining harmony, toot, as listeners reacted without showing it, and began talking, and soon the whole joint is rocking and talking, and everybody talking, and Charlie Parker whistling them on to the brink of eternity with his Irish St. Patrick patoodle stick. And like the holy miss, we blop and we plop in the waters of slaughter and white meat and die one after one in time. And how sweet a story it is when you hear Charlie Parker tell it, either on records or at sessions or at official bits and clubs, shots in the arm for the wallet. Gleefully, he whistled the perfect horn. Anyhow, it made no difference. Charlie Parker, forgive me. Forgive me for not answering your eyes. For not having made an indication of that which you can devise. Charlie Parker, pray for me. Pray for me and everybody. In the nirvanas of your brain where you hide, indulgent and huge, no longer Charlie Parker, with a secret unsayable name that carries with it merit, not to be measured from here to up, down, east, or west. Charlie Parker, lay the bane off me and everybody.
Jack Kerouac and pianist talk show host Steve Allen performing Charlie Parker, Mexico City Blues, and Dead Belly from Mexico City Blues from the 1958 album Poetry for the Beat Generation. We're playing recordings made by the writer Jack Kerouac on this edition of Nightlights, as well as jazz that is somehow connected to him. Jack Kerouac was 35 when his novel, An American Odyssey on the Road, was published in September of 1957, making him a seemingly overnight literary celebrity. Kerouac had actually been writing for many years, and On the Road was his second published novel, but the first to incorporate the jazz-influenced methods of composition that he'd hit upon in his late 20s, something that he and others would come to call spontaneous bop prosody. I want to be considered a jazz poet blowing a long blues in a jam session on Sunday, he once proclaimed, and in notes describing what he saw as a new approach to writing, he said, no period separating sentence structures already arbitrarily riddled by false colons and timid, usually needless commas, but the vigorous space dash separating rhetorical breathing as jazz musician drawing breath between outblown phrases. And jazz figured prominently in the landscape of Kerouac's fiction, perhaps more so than in any other American writer. Novels such as On the Road, Visions of Cody, and The Subterraneans were full of scenes with the characters listening to jazz, watching jazz performances, and talking about jazz. Kerouac and the other Beats were profoundly attracted to the music, which served as their soundtrack for movement, rebellion, and life. We'll hear a Charlie Parker broadcast that captures the energy to which Kerouac and his friends were responding, as well as Kerouac himself, Indiana University professor and musicologist Phil Ford.
You know, Kerouac, what's interesting is when he's cultivating this idea of spontaneous bop prose, and he's writing about this idea of writing at escape velocity, you know, writing so fast and writing in such a spontaneous way that you reach escape velocity, that you escape the gravitational force of your own self-consciousness, and you can just blow. That was the sort of the ideal, and he went looking for confirmation for this literary ideal in jazz.
Jazz,
But one afternoon somewhere on a sidewalk, maybe 1939, 1940, Dizzy Gillespie or Charlie Parker or Thelonious Monk was walking down past a men's clothing store on 42nd Street of South Main in L.A., and from the loudspeaker they suddenly heard a wild and possible mistake in jazz that could only have been heard inside their own imaginary head. And that is a new art, bop. The name derives from an accident. America was named after an Italian explorer, not after an Indian king. Lionel Hampton had made a record called Hey Bob, Rebop, and everybody yelled it, and it was when Lionel would jump in the audience and wail his saxophone at everybody with sweat claps, jumping fools in the aisles, the drummer vastly booming and belaboring on the stage as the whole theater rocked. Sung by Helen Humes, it was a popular record and sold many copies around 1945 or 46. First everyone looked around, then it happened. Bop happened. The bird flew in. Minds went in. On the streets, thousands of new-type hep cats in red shirts and some goatees and strange queer-looking cowboys from the West with boots and belts. And the girls began to disappear from the street somehow. You no longer saw, as in the 30s, the Wrangler walking with his doll in the honky-tonk. Now he was alone. Rebop, bop, came into being because the girls were leaving the guys and going off to be middle-class models or something. And Dizzy or Charlie or Thelonious was walking down the street, heard a noise, a sound, half Lester Young, half raw rainy fog that has that chest-shivering excitement of shack or track or empty lot, the sudden vast tiger head on the wood fence, rainy no-school Saturday morning dump yards. Hey! And rushed off dancing. On the piano that night, Thelonious introduced the wooden off-key note, everybody's warm-up notes. Minton's Playhouse, evening starts. Jam hours later, 10 p.m. Colored bar and hotel next door. One or two white visitors, some from Columbia, some from nowhere, some from ships, some from Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines, some from Europe. The strange note makes the trumpeter of the band lift an eyebrow. Dizzy is surprised for the first time that day. He puts the trumpet to lips and blows a wet blur. Hee-hee-ha! Laughs Charlie Parker, bending down to slap his ankle. He puts his alto to his mouth and says, "Didn't I tell you?" with jazz of notes. Talking eloquent like great poets of foreign languages, singing in foreign countries with lyres by seas. And no one understands because the language isn't alive in the land yet. Bop is the language from America's inevitable Africa. Going is sounded like gong. Africa is the name of the flu and kick beat off to one side. The sudden squeak uninhibited that screams muffled at any moment from Dizzy Gillespie's trumpet. Do anything you want. Drawing the tune aside along another improvisation bridge with a reach-out tear of claws, like, why be subtle and false? The band of 10 p.m. Minton's swings into action. Bird Parker, who was only 18 years old, has a crew cut of Africa, looks impossible, has perfect eyes and composures of a king when suddenly you stop and look at him in the subway, and you can't believe that Bop is here to stay.
Jack Kerouac reading Fantasy, the Early History of Bop, and we also heard Charlie Parker performing Move from One Night in Birdland. Interesting to note that the anniversary of Jack Kerouac's birth is the same as that of Charlie Parker's death. Although Kerouac himself and some of his fans maintain that his work directly imitated jazz's creative methods, Phil Ford says the approach he was employing was more general in aim and nature.
People can argue back and forth like, okay, is Kerouac really using blues forms? Is he really using jazz structures? You know, probably not really. I mean, not on a really detailed or involved level. But what jazz offers is an image of the creative intellect in flight. And it offers an idea of what it is you're doing as a writer or a musician. What it is you're trying to grasp is something that has to do with experience and doesn't necessarily have to do with ideas.
Now it's jazz. The place is roaring. All beautiful girls in there. One mad brunette at the bar, drunk with her boys. One strange chick I remember from somewhere wearing a simple skirt with pockets, her hands in there. Short haircut, slouched, talking to everybody. Up and down the stairs they come. The bartenders are the regular band of Jack and the heavenly drummer who looks up in the sky with blue eyes, with a beard. He's wailing beer caps of bottles and jamming at the cash register, and everything is going to the beat. It's the beat generation. It's Bayat. It's the beat to keep. It's the beat of the heart. It's being beat and down in the world and like old-time lowdown. And like in ancient civilizations, the slave boatmen rowing galleys to a beat. and servants spinning pottery to a beat. The faces. There's no face to compare with Jack Mingers, who's up on the bandstand now, with a colored trumpeter who outblows him wild and dizzy, but Jack's face overlooking all the heads and smoke. He has a face that looks like everybody you've ever known and seen on the street in your time. Sweet face. Hard to describe. Sad eyes, cruel lips, expectant gleam, swaying to the beat, tall, majestical. Waiting in front of the drugstore. A face like Hunky's in New York. Hunky, whom you'll see on Times Square, somnolent and alert, sad, sweet, dark, holy. Just out of jail, martyred, tortured by sidewalks, starved for sex and companionship, open to anything, ready to introduce a new world with a shrug. The colored big tenor with the big tone is blowing sunny stits clear out of Kansas City roadhouses. Clear, heavy, somewhat dull and unmusical ideas which nevertheless never leave the music. Always there, always far out. The harmony too complicated for the motley bums of music understanding in there. But the musicians here. The drummer is a sensational 12-year-old Negro boy who's not allowed to drink, but can play. Tremendous, a little lithe, childlike Miles Davis kid. Like early Fats Navarro fans you used to see in Espan Harlem, hep, small. He thunders at the drums with a beat which is described to me by a near-standing connoisseur with beret as a fabulous beat. On piano is Blondie Bill, good enough to drive any group. Now Jack Minger blows out and over his head with these angels from Fillmore. I dig him. Now he's terrific. I just stand in the outside hall against the wall. No beer necessary, with collections of in-and-out listeners, with Bernie, and now here returns Bob Berman, who is a kid from West Indies, who barged into my party 6 months earlier with Dean and the gang, and I had a Chet Baker record on, and we hoofed it at each other in the room. Tremendous. The perfect grace of his dancing, casual, like Joe Louis, casually hoofing. He comes now in dancing like that, glad. Everybody looks everywhere. It's a jazz joint and Beat Generation mad trick. You see someone, hi. Then you look away elsewhere for something, someone else. It's all insane. Then you look back, you look away, around. Everything is coming in from everywhere in the sound of the jazz. Hi. Hey. Bang. The little drummer takes a solo, reaching his young hands all over traps and kettles and cymbals and foot pedal boom and a fantastic crash of sound. 12 years old. What will happen?
Jack Kerouac reading San Francisco Scene, The Beat Generation, from The Beat Generation, Volume 1. Well, Kerouac is often paired by cultural essayists with bop masters such as Charlie Parker or Thelonious Monk. Jazz writer Larry Cart points out in his essay, Jazz and Jack Kerouac, that Kerouac's true jazz relatives might be considered to be some of the late 1940s white Lester Young-influenced players such as Allen Eager and Brew Moore. Cart, who also points out that Kerouac often engaged in what he called romantic posing when it came to jazz in his fiction, writes, "This dream of participating in the magical it of jazz seems small alongside Kerouac's ability to sustain the rhythm of a paragraph or a chapter on a series of long, swinging, almost literal breaths. Here Kerouac achieved his dream of a prose that shadows the chorus structure of an improvising jazz soloist. I wish Allen Eager would play louder and more distinct," he writes in Book of Dreams, "but I recognize his greatness and his prophetic humility of quietness." Listening to Eager or Moore, one knows what Kerouac meant, a meditative, inward-turning linear impulse that combines compulsive swing with an underlying resignation, as though at the end of each phrase the shape of the line drooped into a melancholy ah me, which would border on passivity if it weren't for the need to move on, to keep the line going. Here's Brew Moore and Blue Brew on Nightlights. Thank you. Rue Moore, a saxophonist sometimes cited in Kerouac's writing, performing Blue Brew from Bebop spoken here. Jack Kerouac on occasion actually recorded with jazz musicians. One such instance was Blues and Haikus, the album he made with two saxophonists he admired, Al Cohn and Zoot Sims. From that album, here's an excerpt of American Haikus.
In my medicine cabinet, the winter fly has died of old age. Well, here I am, 2 p.m. What day is it? The tree looks like a dog barking at heaven. Prayer beads on the holy book, my knees are cold. In the morning frost, the cats step slowly. No telegram today, only more leaves fell. The castle of the Gandharvas is full of aging young couples. Early morning yellow flowers, thinking about the drunkards of Mexico. The national scene, late afternoon sun in those trees. Nightfall, boy smashing dandelions with a stick. Holding up my purring cat to the moon, I sighed. August moon, oh, I got a boil on my thigh. Drunk as a hoot owl, writing letters by thunderstorm. All day long, wearing a hat that wasn't on my head. Beautiful young girls running up the library steps with shorts on. Crossing the football field, coming home from work, the lonely businessman.
Jack Kerouac and Al Kahn and Zoot Sims from their album American Haikus. Kerouac was upset after the session because of what he perceived as indifference on the part of Kahn and Sims. Jazz musicians didn't generally afford Kerouac the reverence that others did. J.J. Johnson's biographers tell a story of the trombonist and Kerouac on a double bill at New York City's Village Vanguard Club. One night, Kerouac, apparently drunk, no surprise there, told J.J. that he always wanted to play jazz, perhaps as a sax player. J.J., in his polite but wry manner, replied, "I'd think of you more as a trumpet man, musicologist Phil Ford."
A lot of jazz musicians then and now have commented, like, well, you know, jazz isn't just like, you don't just stick your horn in your face and blow. I mean, it's this very structured thing. And so the controversy, the, you know, all the friction between beats talking about jazz and actual jazz musicians has to do with that, that sense of like, well, you're sort of thinking of jazz like it's a symbol of something you're trying to accomplish as a writer. The jazz isn't always jazz as it really is in Kerouac's writing. And so that's kind of a perennial difficulty in talking about Kerouac and jazz.
It was with TV talk show host Steve Allen that Kerouac found perhaps his most compatible musical partner. He appeared on Allen's program a number of times and recorded his first official album with Allen, musicologist Phil Ford.
That's a great record because you really hear, like, something of his literary voice comes through in his actual flesh and blood voice. This was one of his great accomplishments as a writer, I think, was that, you know, he really was somebody who thought about writing not just as the encoding of ideas, but as something that could attain something of the character of speech, something of the personality and of a person's voice, that he thought so much in terms of voice. He's the first guy to think in those terms, but he's thinking about it in such, in kind of hipsterish terms, thinking so much in terms of experience and like, how can you as a writer capture something of the ineffable moment of experience?
There was a little alley in San Francisco, back of the Southern Pacific Station at 3rd and Townsend, in red brick of drowsy, lazy afternoons with everybody at work in offices. In the air, you feel the impending rush of their commuter frenzy. As soon they'll be charging en masse from Market and Sansom buildings on foot and in buses and all well-dressed through working man Frisco of walk-up truck drivers. And even the poor grime-bemarked 3rd Street of lost bums, even Negroes, so hopeless and long left east, and meanings of responsibility and try, that now all they do is stand there spitting in the broken glass, sometimes 50 in one afternoon against one wall at 3rd and Howard. Here's all these Milbrae and San Carlos, neat-necktied producers and commuters of America and steel civilization, rushing by with San Francisco Chronicles and green call bulletins, not even enough time to be disdainful. They've got to catch 130, 132, 134, 136, all the way up to 146, till the time of evening supper in homes of the railroad earth, when high in the sky the magic stars ride above the following hotshot freight trains. It's all in California. It's all a sea. I swim out of it in afternoons of sun-hot meditation in my jeans with head on handkerchief on brakeman's lantern or, if not working, on book. I look up at blue sky of perfect lost purity and feel the warp of wood of old America beneath me. And I have insane conversations with Negroes in second-story windows above, and everything is pouring in. The switching moves of boxcars in that little alley, which is so much like the alleys of Lowell, and I hear far off in the sense of coming night that engine calling our mountains. But it was that beautiful cut of clouds I could always see above the little SP alley. Puffs floating by from Oakland, or the gate of Marin to the north, or San Jose south. The clarity of Cal, break your heart. It was the fantastic drowse and drum hum of lum mum afternoon, nothing to do. Old Frisco with end of land sadness. The people. The alley full of trucks and cars of businesses nearabouts. Nobody knew or far from cared who I was all my life, 3,500 miles from birth, all opened up and at last belonged to me in great America. Now it's night in Third Street. The keen little neons and also yellow bulb lights of impossible-to-believe flops. The dark, ruined shadows moving back of torn yellow shades like a degenerate China with no money. The cat's in Annie's alley. The flop comes on, moans, rolls. The street is loaded with darkness. Blue sky above with stars hanging high over old hotel roofs and blowers of hotels mooning out dusts of interior. The grime inside the word in mouths falling out tooth by tooth. The reading rooms tick-tock big clock with creak chair and slant boards and old faces looking up over rimless spectacles bought in some West Virginia or Florida or Liverpool, England pawn shop long before I was born. And across rains, they've come to the end of the land sadness, end of the world gladness. All your San Francisco will have to fall eventually and burn again. But I'm walking, and one night, a bum fell into the hole of the construction job where they're tearing a sewer by day. The husky Pacific and electric youths in torn jeans who work there, often I think of going up to some of them, like, say, blonde ones with wild hair and torn shirts, and they say, you ought to apply for the railroad. It's much easier work. You don't stand around the street all day and you get much more pay. But this bum fell in the hole. You saw his foot stick out. British MG, also driven by some eccentric, once backed into that hole. And as I came home from a long Saturday afternoon local to Hollister out of San Jose, miles away across verdurous fields of prune and juice joy, here's this British MG backed and legs up, wheels up into a pit and bums and cops standing right outside the coffee shop. It was the way they fenced it, but he never had the nerve to do it due to the fact that he had no money and nowhere to go, and oh, his father was dead, and oh, his mother was dead, and oh, his sister was dead, and oh, his whereabout was dead. But and then at that time also, I used to lay in my room on long Saturday afternoons listening to Jumpin' George with my fifth toque, no tea, and just under the sheets laugh to hear the crazy music. Mama, he treats your daughter mean. Mama, Papa, don't you come in here, I'll kill you, etc. Getting high by myself in room glooms, and all wondrous knowing about the Negro, the essential American, out there, always finding his solace, his meaning, in the fellaheen street, and not an abstract morality. And even when he has a church, you see the pastor out front bowing to the ladies on the make. You hear his great vibrant voice on the Sunday afternoon sidewalk full of sexual vibratos, saying, why, yes, ma'am, but the gospel do say that man was born of woman's womb. No, and so, by that time I come crawling out of my warm sack and hit the street. When I see the railroad ain't gonna call me till 5 a.m. Sunday morning, probably, for a local out of Bay Shore. In fact, always for a local out of Bay Shore. And I go to the whale bar of all the wild bars in the world, the one and only Third and Howard. And there I go in and drink with the madmen, and if I get drunk, I get. The girl who come up to me in there one night, I was there with Al Buckle, said to me, you wanna play with me tonight, Jim? And I didn't think I had enough money. And I told this to Charlie Lowe, and he laughed, said, how do you know she wanted money? Always take the chance that she might be out just for love, or just out for love. You know what I mean. Don't be a sucker. She was a good-looking doll. And she said, how would you like to ooliuku with me, mon? And I stood there like a jerk. In fact, bought drink, got drink drunk that night in the 299 Club. I was hit by the proprietor, the band breaking up the fight, before I had a chance to decide to hit him back, which I didn't want to do anyway. Not on the street. I tried to rush back in, but they had locked the door and were looking at me through the forbidden glass in the door with faces like undersea. I should have played with her shoo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-ka-dookie.
Jack Kerouac and Steve Allen performing October on the Railroad Earth from their album Poetry for the Beat Generation. We'll have more music and spoken word performances in just a few moments. Production support for this program comes from the Laughing Planet Cafe and Soma Coffee House and Juice Bar on the corner of Kirkwood and Grant in Bloomington, Indiana. This is David Brent Johnson, and you're listening to Jazz and Jack Kerouac on Nightlights.
Tip my cup, all my doors are open. Cut my thoughts for coconuts, all my eggs are broken. Hop my heart song, hop my hide. Seraphs hold me steady. Hit my angel, hide my light. Lay it on the lady.
Playing recordings that the writer Jack Kerouac made and jazz that has some kind of connection with him on this edition of Nightlights. You can listen to many previous Nightlights programs on our website at nightlights.indiana.edu. One of them is about the jazz soundtrack for The Subterraneans, which so far is the only movie to be adapted from a Jack Kerouac novel. Kerouac had nothing to do with the film version of The Subterraneans and in fact was quite appalled by it, but he did participate in an underground film that's become a beat legend called Pull My Daisy. Based on part of an abandoned Kerouac play, it featured a number of beat circle members such as Allen Ginsberg and Gregory Corso invading the apartment of a railroad brakeman and his wife. Jazz musician David Amram did the score and Kerouac provided the narration, supposedly recording it in a drunken, spontaneous state. However, much of what he did record was shifted around later on for artistic effect. Phil Ford.
It's funny how you get this wonderful conjoining of image and word in Pull My Daisy. And yet it is very much product of, and it feels spontaneous, and yet is very much product of calculation and a kind of retrospective, composerly way of dealing with artistic materials.
Ford also points out that Pull My Daisy, made 2 years after On the Road turned Kerouac into a literary star, is a kind of requiem for the author's pre-celebrity life.
Pull My Daisy is very interesting from that point of view. It's a very nostalgic film. You know, it's this image of, you know, the beat life, of beat, of social, sort of like footloose and loose-limbed and carefree sort of sociability. But it's very idealized, you know, already in 1959, which is when that film was made, that was basically something that Kerouac could remember but couldn't participate in anymore.
Gregory Corso and Allen Ginsberg there. Laying there, beer cans out on the table, bringing up all the wine, wearing hoods and parkas, falling on the couch, all bursting with poetry while she's saying, now you get your coat, get your little hat, and we're going to go off to school. Health to you this morning, Mr. Hart Crane, old bridge. I said, look at all those cars out there. There's nothing out there but a million screaming 90-year-old men being run over by gasoline trucks. So throw the match on it. And here comes old Mez McGillicuddy right down the line there banging on the organ. There says, hey, yo, daddy, says, and she says, oh, if that was not enough. Old Mez McGillicuddy, who's disturbed her many a midnight evening. And old Milo, he's quite pleased to see him there, because he don't, and, but at the same time, he has to talk to Bishop.
It's all right, says, son, perfect, all right, he's all right, he's my good friend. There. He's my good friend. Oh, buddy Mez, Mez gone in the toilet to do something. They sit around the table, now they're getting kind of congenial. By God, even the woman feels good, and she walks around old Milo there and sits down, and the Bishop is feeling pretty good there. He's got some other things to tell him. He's got his own thoughts, and meanwhile, Mez coming out of the toilet. Yes, sir, he says. He comes out and shakes hands with the bishop's sister, Sal Young, and he knows old Allen there and shapes up hands with the bishop's mother. And then he comes up and he shakes hands with the bishop himself. Coffee cockroaches, stove cockroaches, city cockroaches, spot cockroaches, melted cheese cockroaches, flour cockroaches, chaplain cockroaches, peanut butter cockroaches, cockroach, cockroach of the eyes. Cockroach, mirror, boom. Now let's sing, Bishop. A holy flower's holy, is the world holy? Is glasses holy? Is time holy? Is all the white moonlight holy? Empty rooms are holy, kneel holy. Come on, Bishop, tell us. Toy holy, Byzantine holy, mock holy. Is American flag holy? Is girl holy? Is your sister holy? What is holy? Holy, 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 holy. And car holy, and light holy. Is holy, holy, are you holy? I see that. I think it's best that I go now and go make my holy offices. If you know what I mean. And Mother, I think we'd better go home now. It's almost 11 o'clock. And the wife comes over and says, is it really almost 11 o'clock? I didn't notice. Meanwhile, these guys aren't paying any attention to all that. They're just blowing. But the other cats are over there talking, and they're not impolite. Some of them are doing something, and some of them are saying goodbye. Doing something and saying goodbye and saying goodbye and doing something are both the same. And do you really have to leave now? I said, we really do. She says, well, look, don't leave. And he says, yes, come, sister, I'll get your coat. She says, I really don't want you to leave. I think we're all having a... He says, yes. He says, but I think I'd better leave there. Hey there, he turns around, Milo says, then little boy there, you're gonna sit on my lap because you can't sleep anymore? He says, what are you doing up there so late? I know what you want to do. He says, yes, I'll play my horn. He's all right, let's go, boy.
Jack Kerouac narrating along with David Amram's score for the film Pull My Daisy. Even as Kerouac was beginning to look backward in Pull My Daisy, those who were reading him were beginning to move into the 1960s. The jazz that he loved so much would go through its own wrenching changes and challenges in the years to come. The 50s had been full of a quiet turbulence, and Kerouac's rise was just one registration of the events in store. Phil Ford.
On one hand, 1950s, people remember that as... you know, a really conservative time and really static time, and the kind of cliche images that people have in their mind are like, you know, Ozzie and Harriet and Leave It to Beaver and this and that, and it just seems like the whitest decade ever. But the paradox of change is like at the precise moment that you have the greatest appearance of hegemony and of a hegemony of total whiteness and a kind of appearance of political and cultural stasis is the precise moment that that stasis is breaking up absolutely and forever, that there's a kind of a great sort of subterranean rumbling. And people can't even necessarily feel it, but it's happening. Everything's shifting around down there.
Jack Kerouac helped set the stage for much of the countercultural upheaval that would follow the 1950s, even if he himself grew to disapprove of much of it later on, and his writings would continue to influence future generations as well. In the decades following his death in 1969, numerous artists, musicians, painters, and fellow writers appropriated his legacy for their own creative work. One such artist was jazz singer Mark Murphy, who recorded two albums in the 1980s that invoked Kerouac, interpolating some of his writings into jazz numbers. It wasn't really a conscious thing, Murphy later said. I'd be in airports and train stations and I'd find these Kerouac books in paperback. I thought that I could entwine his storytelling with this huge well of music that I could dip into. Mark Murphy singing Parker's Mood and reciting from Jack Kerouac's The Subterraneans on Nightlights.
Come with me if you want to go to Kansas City. Full of sorrow, don't hardly know what to do. Where will I be tomorrow? Going to Kansas City, wanna go to, you know you can't make it with me. Going to Kansas City, sorry, but I can't take you. When you see me coming, raise your windows high. When you see me leaving, baby, hang your head and cry. I'm afraid there's nothing in this creamy, dreamy town a honky-tonk monkey woman could do. She'd only bring herself down. So long, everybody. The time is coming, I must leave you. So if I don't ever see your smiling face again, make a promise you'll remember like a Christmas day in December that I told you all through thick and thin, all up to the end. Parker's been your friend. Don't hang your head when you see those six pretty horses pulling me. Put a $20 silver piece on my watch chain, look at the smile on my face, sing a little song and tell the world that I'm really free. Cry for me, 'cause I'm going to Kansas City. We went to the Red Drum to hear the jazz, which that night was Charlie Parker, with Honduras Jones on drums and others interesting, probably Roger Beloit, to whom I wanted to see now in that excitement of soft night San Francisco bop. And up on the stand, Bird Parker with solemn eyes, who'd been busted fairly recently and had now returned to a kind of bop dead Frisco, but had just discovered or been told about the Red Drum, the great new generation gang wailing and gathering there. So here he was on the stand, examining them with his eyes as he blew his now settled down into regulated design crazy notes. The booming drums, the high ceiling, to hear Bird, whom I saw distinctly digging Mardu several times, also myself, directly into my eye, looking to search if really I was that great writer I thought myself to be. As if he knew my thoughts and ambitions, or remembered me from other nightclubs and other coasts, other Chicagos. Not a challenging look, but the king and founder of the bop generation, at least the sound of it, in digging his audience, digging his eyes, the secret eyes, him watching as he just pursed his lips and let great lungs and immortal fingers work, his eyes separate and interested and humane, the kindest jazz musician there could be while being, and therefore, naturally, the greatest. Come with me if you want to go to Kansas City.
Mark Murphy singing Parker's Mood from his 1981 album Bop for Kerouac, and Richie Cole on saxophone. Jack Kerouac, as Larry Cart and others have pointed out, is often romanticized when it comes to his association with jazz. But there's no doubt that he really did love the music and that its influence upon him was profound. As Kerouac increasingly becomes a part of the American literary canon, the bop reverberations that he managed to capture in his writing, that were a part of the way he wrote and thought and lived himself, that were a part of the way Americans lived in the mid-20th century, transmuted now into codified pulses, continue to vibrate through the thousands of pages that he left us, reminding us that life is sometimes grasped significantly in a single moment, and that thousands of hours may go into what makes up that moment. Phil Ford.
He doesn't want to write one of those ponderous message novels, of which there are many in the 50s. What is it that jazz means? You know, he doesn't really, what's cool is that he's not really trying to write what does it mean. He wants to capture the moment where two guys are actually in the moment experiencing a piece of jazz and grooving with it. And, you know, they're saying a lot of Stone Bull that's sort of flying by, but somehow in the flow of talk that he's transcribing, there is captured something of the, you know, what jazz actually is, what it does mean. it's a little bit like the trick of, you know, like if you go out in a starry night and there's sometimes a star that's like really faint. And if you look at it head on, if you just look at, focus on it, it'll disappear. And the only way you could see a faint light like that is to actually focus a few inches off to one side, and then it'll appear in your peripheral vision. You know, something, and it's like, what's the hard thing to talk about? It's to talk about what jazz means. What is it? You know, what's the it? You know, this line towards the end of Visions of Cody. What's the it? You know, the it, this ineffable it. And that, that's something that is really almost like impossible to meet head on. You can't just look straight at it and say, okay, that's what it is. You have to do something else. You have to move a little bit off to the side and catch it in your peripheral vision. And that's the brilliance of Kerouac's best writing, is that he's not trying to emulate jazz structures. He's not trying to be a jazz musician, but only in, you know, prose form. It's when he is attaining something in parallel with jazz.
Out we jumped in the warm, mad night, hearing a wild tenor man's bawling horn across the way going, ee-yah, ee-yah, and hands clapping to the beat, and folks yelling, go, go, go. And far from escorting the girls into the place, Dean Moriarty was already racing across the street with his huge bandaged thumb in the air, yelling, blow, man, blow! And a bunch of colored men in Saturday night suits were whooping it up in front. It was a sawdust saloon, all wood, with a small bandstand near the john on which the fellas huddled with their hats on, blowing over people's heads. A crazy place, not far from Market Street, in the dingy skid row rear of it, Howard Street. Folsom Street, actually, near Harrison and the Big Bridge Causeway. Crazy, floppy women wandered around sometimes in their bathrobes. Bottles clanked in alleys. In back of the joint in the dark corridor, beyond the splattered toilets, scores of men and women stood against the wall drinking wine spodiote and spitting at the stars. Wine spodiote being wine, whiskey, and beer. And the behatted tenor man was blowing at the peak of a wonderfully satisfactory free idea. A rising and falling riff that went from Ia to a crazier Ilia and blasted along to the rolling crash of butt-scarred drums hammered by a big, brutal-looking, curl-sconced guy with a bull neck who didn't give a damn about anything but punishing his tubs. Crash, rattle-tee-boom, crash, uproars of music, and the tenor man had it, and everybody knew he had it, and Dean was clutching his head in the crowd, and it was a mad crowd. They were all urging that tenor man to hold it and keep it with cries and wild eyes. He was raising himself from a crouch and going down again with his horn, looping it up in a clear cry above the furor. A 6-foot skinny woman was rolling her bones at the man's horn bell, and he just jabbed it at her, playing E, E, E. He had a foghorn tone. His horn was taped. He was a shipyard worker, and he didn't care. Everybody was rocking and roaring. Our girls, Galatea and Alice, with beers in their hands, were standing on the chairs, shaking and jumping. Groups of colored studs stumbled in from the street, falling over one another to get there. "Stay with it, man," roared a man with a foghorn voice, and let out a big groan that must have been heard clear to Sacramento. "Ha-ha!" "Wow," said Dean. He was rubbing his chest, his belly, his T-shirt was out. The sweat splashed from his face. Boom, kick, that drummer was kicking his drums down the cellar and rolling the beat upstairs with his murderous sticks, rattledy boom. Big fat man was jumping on the platform, making it sag and creak. Woo! The pianist was only pounding the keys with spread-eagled fingers, chords only. At intervals when the great tenor man was drawing breath for another blast of phrase, Chinese chords, they shuddered the piano and every timber, chink and wire. Boing! And the tenor man jumped down from the platform and just stood buried in the crowd, blowing around. His hat was over his eyes. Somebody pushed it back for him. He just hauled back and stamped his foot and blew down a hoarse, bawling blast and drew breath and raised the horn high and blew high, wide, and screaming in the air. And Dean was directly in front of him with his face glued to the bell of the horn, clapping his hands, pouring sweat on the man's keys. And the man noticed and laughed in his horn, a long, quivering, crazy mule's hee-haw, and everybody else laughed, and they rocked. And finally the tenor man decided to blow his top, and crouched down and squatted on the floor and held a note in high C for a long time as everything else crashed along skittily boom and the cries increased, and I thought the cops would come swarming from the nearest precinct. It was just a usual Saturday night good time.
We close with Jack Kerouac reading from On the Road. Thanks for tuning into this edition of Nightlights. Special thanks to Phil Ford. You can listen to this and previous Nightlights broadcast and view playlists on our website at nightlights.indiana.edu. Production support for Nightlights comes from the Laughing Planet Cafe and Soma Coffee House and Juice Bar in Bloomington, Indiana. Nightlights is engineered by Michael Paskash and produced in the studios of WFIU at Indiana University. This is David Brent Johnson wishing you good listening for the week ahead. Thank you.